Accession number 4600, reel 2.
Flight Lieutenant Townsend, reel 2.
The Ardex, on the other hand, was, for a start, had a liquid-cooled engine with a radiator which was partly withdrawn in flight and which used to poke fair volumes of warm air up into the both the front and the rear cockpits. And it was a much less drafty aeroplane, although it's still open cockpit, of course. It was a much less drafty aeroplane than the Atlas. And by and large, what with the warm air and the freedom from drafts, it was a joy to fly in that. We were still facing the tail, which is not the best way of flying in an aeroplane. But
why not?
Oh, it doesn't feel right to be flying backwards. But the trick of it, of course, for Army Co-op was that we had a gun ring in the rear cockpit, a scarf ring, for mounting a Lewis gun. And the only way you could operate that was to have a small kick-up seat which faced the tail. And, of course, the radio had to go behind the rear cockpit. It was a fairly hefty piece of apparatus in those days. And that went behind the cockpit, so, okay, one had to face aft to operate it. As simple as that.
Can you say a bit more about what Army cooperation involved in those days?
Yes, it really, the primary object was supposed to be for gun spotting. And we had exercises every summer on Salisbury Plain. And an aircraft would take off, and with using WT, they would observe fall of shot from a particular battery and signal it back to the chap, myself included, with the airman with a pack set attached to the particular battery. And that really was our prime function. It a subsidiary function also seemed to be getting the results of the day's races for the officer in charge of the battery, but that was quite unofficial. It was quite a good exercise to be on, in point of fact. Although when I started at Old Sarum, we still had horse-drawn batteries. The motorised ones were only just coming in, and the dread of our lives was to get attached to a horse-drawn battery, because these gun limbers had no springs on them at all, and you were just bouncing across Salisbury Plain, hanging on to your allegedly portable radio, which was a bit hefty anyway. And we also carried with us a large bag containing a tent, a one-man tent, and a couple of blankets, and any small kit that we like to take along with us. So clinging on to this lot, bouncing across Salisbury Lane, was a quite a feat in itself. And then, of course, when you came to a little bit of a slope up, the battery commander would yell dismount and everybody off to give the poor horses a chance. But of course, motor-drawn batteries were a completely different proposition, and we always looked for those if we possibly could.
When did the horses go out?
Oh, there were still some horse-drawn batteries when I left El Sarum in 1935. So quite when they finished with them, I really wouldn't know. But I was glad to see the back of them, believe you me.
How effective do you think the training was for Army cooperation?
The training was technically effective for any sort of situation, I think. Looking back on it, I still consider that we were trained better in 3 years than any civilian would have been trained in the same sort of time by going to a company even the best company in the land. We were there on the spot, and we, you know, we were got at, and we were screwed down, and we were thoroughly trained. And because of the educational side, we were better trained technically than practically anybody outside. You see, radio was taught to us first of all as an educational subject, not as a practical subject. It was taught to us as an educational subject, and so we were taken through the theory of the radio components by an education officer and taught it properly. And frankly, it stood me in very, very good stead ever since, because obviously the basic theory of radio and radio components is still the same as it ever was.
Was 16 Squadron a good one to be with?
Yes, we thought it was. The atmosphere on the station was very good, in point of fact, because summarise it by saying that as long as you did your job, no one chased you around, and it really was as simple as that. It was a lovely station to be on. It was only just over the hill from Salisbury itself, which was a very reasonable city to be stationed in. I did, in fact, learn a bit more then about the attitude of civilians to the Royal Air Force. I'm sorry, but I have to keep dragging in music, but I very quickly got myself playing piano and so on in Salisbury, and playing with a civilian band. And in one particular restaurant where we played a lot, I went with the proprietor of that place to a local fete, where he was having some Tannoy advertising done. He wanted to hear it come over the air himself. And I drove him up. Well, I wasn't a very good driver at the time, but I could drive. And we had a bit of trouble with the old motor car that he borrowed for the occasion. I drove him up there and back. And we were stopped on the way back into Salisbury, and some of the local fire brigade, in plain clothes, in their car, stopped because they recognised my colleague to ostensibly to see if they could do anything for us. And we assured them that we were all right, so they carried on. We'd only gone about another 100 or 200 yards, and we were stopped by the police. And my colleague John Mason, who was a splendid chap, he said, "No, you know, the bastards, these fire brigade boys have told the police that we were broken down and in a bit of bother, and so they've stopped us." And although I was stone sober, I knew I have never been a drinking man, but I know then I was completely stone sober, and there was no reason for anyone on earth to think anything other than that. And yet the coffer made me get out of the car and walk the chalk line. And my friend said afterwards that was because you're in the Air Force. And there was a fair bit of that sort of feeling. I suppose it wasn't very long after the First War ended. And there, a lot of people had experience in the trenches, a lot of men had experience in the trenches, and it must have been a pretty brutalizing experience at that. And the only relation they could establish between an airman and anyone else was that he was in uniform like the soldiers used to be, and therefore he was in the same category as the brutal and licentious soldiery, and that was it.
So it was that rather than any idea that the RAF were a bunch of tearaways?
I think so, yes, I think so. Obviously, there was a certain amount of association of I know what you call devil may care, anybody connected with aircraft. You had to be a bit of a nut, I suppose, to go off in an airplane, but there was a certain element of that, yes. But it, I think I put it down mostly to the connection with anyone in uniform, and that automatically is a soldier in the trenches. I don't know, I may be wrong.
How did you come to leave 16 Squadron?
Well, I was posted. I'd only been there, in fact, a year when I had a posting came through to Iraq. And that was one of the dreaded postings in the 30s because, an overseas posting then was 5 years, period. It was, there was no question of coming home in under 5 years. Did 2 years in Iraq and then 3 years somewhere a little less bloody than that, and by and large it wasn't a posting to be sought after, but nevertheless there I was posted to Iraq in 1934. So I duly went for a medical for the boat, and the MO did the usual thing of saying turn your head and cough, and which I did, and he said, my God, you've got a little hernia, so we can't possibly send you off to Iraq. And what happened then was rather amusing, because he got me into the military hospital at I think Tidworth, obviously another one on Salisbury Plain, as being the nearest service hospital where I could be operated upon. And my entry to the hospital was apparently fixed, and I duly reported to the place, or was taken over to the place, and the next thing was I found myself on the morning sick parade, the Army morning sick parade. And the when I eventually got through to the medical officer after about 2 hours wait, he said, oh yes, you've got a little hernia. And I said, yes, that's right, sir. I've come over to have it operated upon. Oh my goodness, you can't possibly be operated upon now. Although you're supposed to be admitted to hospital, we can't possibly take you today. You'll have to go back to your station and we'll send for you. Which I did, but then when I got back to Old Sarum, it rather threw the place into confusion, because I had been put up on daily routine orders as admitted to hospital at Tidworth, and here I was back on the station. So the MO said, well, you better just stay in the sick bay, move your quarters into the sick bay. And I said, well, please, what about going out tonight, sir? Is that allowed? And he said, yeah, well, yes, but you can't book out because you're not here. So you just sneak out through the hedge or something and then sneak back in again when you feel like it, and off we go. So, but he said, meanwhile, I'll see if I can get you into Halton instead of Tidworth. And in fact, my admission to the hospital at Halton came through earlier than the one to Tidworth, so off I went to Halton. Much to my relief, I might add.
And how long were you at Halton?
I was there for almost a month altogether, because a hernia operation in those days meant 21 days bed rest after the operation. And this was in December 34, and I did in fact get up slightly before the 21 days was up so that I could walk round the wards and see the Christmas decorations. But technically it was 21 days in bed before I was allowed up at all. I mean, now of course you're slung out of hospital after 2 or 3 days.
And what happened to you after your hospital treatment?
Well, I was back to Old Sarum, and of course I was then excused overseas for 12 months. It must have been rather less than 12 months, because by the August 35 I was then posted to Fleet Air Arm. But that was a 2-year posting to a cruiser and not even a carrier. And so I consider I was very fortunate.
Why?
Well, just 2 years. 2 years overseas and instead of five. Fleet Air Arm then, by the way, was manned by the Air Force on the technical side. All the odd jobs, of course, were still done by the Navy, but the technical trades and the aircraft were provided by the Royal Air Force. Much to the Navy's disgust, of course.
What was the reputation of the Fleet Air Arm in the rest of the RAF?
Oh, it was all that anyone knew, all that I certainly ever heard about, was from people who'd been on carriers. And this was not a particularly good life, but there again, it was outweighed by the fact that it was only a two and a half year stint instead of five.
Why was it not a good life?
Life in a carrier is not very pleasant, I believe. I'd never experienced it, thank goodness, but for a start you have to sling a hammock and sleep in that, and the quarters are very crowded. Although a carrier seems to be a fairly hefty vessel, there's not an awful lot of space for bodies. Lots of space for airplanes, but not much space for bodies.
And was a cruiser for you any better?
Yes, it was, because we there were only four of us, four tradesmen from the Air Force in this cruiser. It was one rigger, one engine fitter, myself as the wireless and electrical mechanic, and one fitter armourer. And that was it. So the four of us, with a ship's company of 600, we were very much an unknown quantity as far as the ship's crew were concerned, and they tended rather to leave us alone. And on top of that, we had one catapult carrying one stainless steel Osprey, which was the Fleet Air Arm derivative of the Hart. And underneath the catapult, we had what was ostensibly a workshop. But it was big enough, in fact, for the four of us to sleep up there. We used to sling our hammocks up there and sleep and work up there. So we were we were much more on our own, with our own sorts of people. And although we got on extremely well with the ship's company, we never really belonged to them.
Whose orders were you under directly?
Oh, under our pilot was a naval officer, and he was the CO of our flight. So we had to answer to him, and of course we're under naval discipline. And I should chip in here that one thing that always rankled with us was that our NCO was, we only had one NCO, and he was a corporal. And so we were the corporal and three LACs. Now, we were all ex-apprentices. In other words, we were all well-trained. Perhaps not quite as well-trained as naval artificers, but nevertheless, we were trained. We were in that sort of category, we always considered. And yet, as far as the Navy were concerned, we were ranked as able seamen. So our privileges when we were in port were only those of an able seaman.
What about operating wireless equipment in aircraft of the Fleet Air Arm? Was it any different to operating equipment in land-based aircraft?
Oh, yes. We had the same old radio sets, I'm afraid, at first in the Osprey, as the TF and the T-21. And again, the performance wasn't very good. It was a bit better over sea than over land, of course, but it still wasn't particularly brilliant. And on top of that, we also had a naval observer who used to do the bulk of the operating. I had to do very little of it, in point of fact, just keep the radio going, and he did most of the operating. But they were doing different jobs, obviously. The function of a cruiser-borne aircraft was really just for spotting the enemy fleet. And I must confess, I well remember one occasion when I ruined a whole fleet exercise by forgetting to plug my set into the trailing aerial and sending the poor observer off with the really with the radio inoperative, and all he had to do was to find the opposing fleet, you know, the blue fleet and the red fleet sort of thing, find the opposing fleet and crack off a short sighting signal and come back to his ship as fast as he could. There was to be no acknowledgement or anything like that. Well, he just banged out his sighting signal and shot off back, and of course the two fleets never met. So he was a little bit fed up when he landed, because in point of fact, I was very sorry about it, because he was a very nice chap indeed, and WT failures went very much against an observer's record, and I know he got a shocking rocket for it, for that particular one, and he sent for me afterwards and said, well, one more WT failure and I've had my chips as an observer, which wouldn't have been funny, but there it was one of those things, I'm afraid. I got put on a charge for it, but I managed to talk a bit rapid and got away with just being admonished. That was only the second charge I was ever on.
You haven't actually said what the name of the ship that you were on.
Oh, Shropshire. HMS Shropshire. That was one of the county-class cruisers, affectionately known as Tinclad. They were built for speed and endurance, and they had no armour. Virtually no armour. I think it was a little bit of amidships, but very, very little. And the observer always used to say the theory was that any shell hitting them would come from long range anyway, and so it would go through the deck and out at the bottom, and nobody would be hurt very much. But they were very fast. They really were very, very fast ships. And we used to love it when we did the quarterly full power trial. It used to work up to full power, and depending on the state of the ship's bottom at the time, so it determined the speed that they did on a full power trial. But it was always above 30 knots, and frankly, as far as we could find out from our friends in the engine room, it was generally knocking on 40, 42 miles an hour on a full power trial. And they had enough endurance to go right around the earth, so they were good ships.
What about the problems of landing and taking off from a cruiser?
Well, in the theory was that in the event of hostilities, the aeroplane would be shot off once from the catapult with wheels on. We could incidentally fit either wheels or floats. And in wartime, it would be shot off with wheels on, do its job, and then hopefully find the nearest aerodrome or the nearest dry land. If there wasn't any dry land, it was hard luck for the pilot and observer. But in peacetime, we normally had flutes fitted, and so instead of shooting it off on the catapult, a crane would lift it and lower it to the water, and then it would take off the water on its floats, land back on the water, and be lifted back on board again.
Did that work well?
Oh yes, it worked very well, except that of course, having main planes and a tail plane, one of which has to come either side of the jib of a crane, obviously you've got to have handling lines on the aircraft and somebody with a bit of common sense on the handling lines. Well, they used to put jolly jacks on the end of the handling lines, about half a dozen large sailors pulling away like mad, and a petty officer telling them to either pull or let go. And it's not the most efficient way of handling an aeroplane. And very frequently we had to do repairs either to the main plane or the tail plane. There was one celebrated occasion in when we got jangled up with the Civil War around Spain, and a celebrated occasion, a merchant ship came in when we were tied up off Valencia doing guardship there, and reported a floating mine. Well, this is not a good thing to have bobbing about on the water, so the skipper decided to send a boat out, and send a motorboat out to look for it, and also send the aircraft up. Now, obviously, off Spain, with a war going on ashore, although we were about 4 miles off, normally there was no flying. You just don't stick your neck out by flipping aeroplanes around the sky. So, but he decided this was serious enough to send the aeroplane off, so it shot off on the catapult. And because it was a rather hot day in the summer and a completely still day with no wind, they wound up the catapult so that it would give it the maximum push off the end. And off went the motorboat and off went the aeroplane. And unfortunately, we'd never found... I had to go out with the motorboat because what the aircraft was going to do was to chuck out a sea marker, which is a little box of aluminium powder. If he saw the mine, he would chuck out a sea marker, and the motorboat would approach and hopefully, I think, blow it up with a rifle shot or something like that. But I was in the motorboat. I was detailed to go out in the motorboat because none of the sailors knew what a sea marker looked like, and I presume they couldn't imagine what some aluminium powder would look like on the surface of the water. So I had to go, and the aeroplane, which by the way we'd then changed for a Walrus, we lost the Osprey and got a Walrus instead, which with a pusher airscrew, and the we didn't find the mine. The motorboat came back in, the aircraft landed near the ship, and it was hooked on the crane and by the telegraphist air gunner. And with a pusher airplane, with a pusher airscrew, you have to cut the engine as soon as the thing, as soon as the crane is hooked on. Otherwise, the crane hook is going to hit the prop. So the chap hooked on, but the pilot thought he hadn't. And so he applied some throttle and steered the airplane out from the ship's side. And the inevitable happened. Of course, the airplane strained on the end of the crane wire. The engine was then cut because the bob weight on the crane hit the prop and broke it, which the pilot heard the bang. So the airplane was pulled back into the ship's side, which wrote off the tailplane. And then by bad handling coming in, they also wrote off a couple of wingtips. And by the way, the catapult also went completely unserviceable. That was bent out of all recognition because they'd wound the thing up too far, and the cordite charge which blew the airplane off also wrecked the catapult.